Good morning. My name is Bill, and I'm an alcoholic. This morning, what we thought we'd do is, where we left off at the last workshop, we were talking about how to do it. And the three of us got together and kind of felt that there was more that we'd like to say about that. This session is really about, supposed to be about the results of sponsoring and working with others. What are the benefits that we derive from that? What kind of results do we get from it on a personal level? And I think you can hear a lot about that in each one of our personal stories. Our thrust is that when you work with others, especially on an in-depth level, that you exercise the intimacy muscle. That you learn how to be close, you learn how to open your heart, you learn how to be forgiving and compassionate and understanding, and yet firm and focused, and become your own person and not have to give yourself away in order to get something in return. All of those things that each one of us on an individual level struggle with at one level or another. And in our personal stories, I think you can hear that. So what we'd like to do is spend a little bit of time up front today in this session talking more about how we, our personal experience with working with others. And then what we're going to do is we're going to go into a description of a group inventory. Our home group had an explosion a while ago, and we ended up going through the process of doing an inventory. And this all pertains to unity, where the recovery of the individual is dependent upon a direct correlation with the unity of the group, the oneness of all of us. And that is another process of getting out of ourselves and into others, identifying with the group on a higher level than self-identification. So we're going to try and do that this morning. We're going to kind of try to stuff a lot in there. To start off with, I've had a lot of personal experience of working with men. And I've had some grand adventures, and I've had some heart-wrenching experiences with them, plus and minus. But one thing that's never happened to me, no one has ever thrown the big book at me. But it has happened to Matthew.
My name's Matthew. I'm an alcoholic. Good morning. One of the great benefits for me when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and I met these men is that they gave me simple things to go by, and one of them was you never say no to anyone. We don't pick and choose who we sponsor, and that's easy because when I want to say no, all I have to do is go, what's the rule? Oh, yeah, I don't say no. I have had the experience of sponsoring a lot of men. I'll tell you quickly how I got a big book thrown at me. There was this guy I was sponsoring named Jason. He was a likable guy, but he had a lot of anger. And we would get together, and he wanted me to sponsor him, and I'd read the book with him, but he never did anything. He never did any steps. He balked and balked and balked, and he'd put me off. And so one day we were meeting in Santa Monica, California. There's a place where there's a cliff, an overhang, and it's a beautiful park, and you can sit on the benches there. And we have a meeting there at lunchtime, so I think I got there around 11 to read the book with him. And we were walking to the park from his business, and we had our big books in our hands. And he said, I don't understand it. I'm not drinking, and I'm going to meetings, but my life isn't changing. And I was walking a few feet ahead of him, and I said, well, I understand it. You do nothing that I tell you to do. You haven't done a single step in the book. You don't do the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Of course your life isn't changing. And as I turned around to see what his reaction was, I saw this big book going, and I ducked. And it went not over my head. It would have hit me right in the face, but it went over the cliff and landed on Pacific Coast Highway. And we were joking this morning, you know, there's probably some rich guy driving by in his convertible thinking, I should get sober, and the big book fell out of the... now, my response to Jason when he did that to me is probably not the great example of love and compassion. I basically said this to him, and... for the tape, it's a universal symbol of love. And and I walked away from him. I mean, I don't think I need to put up with actual physical abuse, you know. And I walked away, and I went around the block to our meeting, and he came around the block the other way, and he saw me in the doorway, and he said, "No one has ever loved me like you love me. I'm so sorry." And he hugged me, and he was crying, and I was like, "Shit, I have to keep sponsoring this guy." And I was feeling some freedom before that, and I'd called Bill, and Bill said, "You do not." Bill, first of all, said, "You have now entered the AA Hall of Fame. You've had someone throw a big book at you." And but then he also said, "You don't have to put up with that." And Jason eventually did work the steps with someone else, and I never fired him. I stayed with him. But what we want to convey, and what I'd like to convey with my 10 minutes about how and a little bit of the results for me, is that the there's an example I'd like to give that happened to me early in sobriety when I was, I think, in my first 100 days. And I used to go to this men's stag meeting at noon, and there was a guy, we'd sit in a circle, and the guy would, we'd share, each person shares. There was a guy sitting next to me, an older guy I'd never seen before, and it was coming to me, and I shared, about the awkwardness I was feeling being newly sober, you know. People weren't celebrating my driver's license, and people, you know, I felt lonely, and I felt alienated. And I didn't, I just felt a little bit adrift, and I was feeling a little bit sorry for myself. And then it got to be his turn, and he looked at me, and he said, "You know, that's real stuff you're going through. That's tough. That's real stuff. That's part of the recovery process, and we know that it's painful. And please stay here, and please stay close with us, because that will pass." And I felt a real compassion and a real openness from him and a real love from him. And then he shared that they were about to amputate his leg. And he said, "You know, he had diabetes, and they're going to amputate his leg." And I thought, it was very clear to me that he had a spiritual center, and he had a maturity that I was wanting. He put me first. He talked to me. He calmed me down. He was about to get his leg cut off, and he took a minute with me and said, "That's real stuff. Don't worry. We know what you're going through, and we'll help you." And I that generosity of spirit is the only way for me to get that. If self-centeredness and selfishness is the root of my problem, and take my word for it, it is. Is for me to put myself out there and get, it's sort of like those rock polishing kits when you're a kid. They just have to be rubbed and rubbed and rubbed and rubbed and rubbed until they smooth out. And I go to many lengths to sponsor people. So I'd like to keep this concrete. And what I learned from the men who sponsored me is you read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, starting with the doctor's opinion, which used to be page 1. And just to throw a little bit of gasoline on this fire about whether sponsorship is mentioned in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, on the first page of the doctor's opinion, the doctor says, "This man impressed upon me the need for people to continue to reach out to other people and to pass this along." Sponsorship is mentioned on the first page of the big book and throughout the big book. It's called Working with Others. And it's often mentioned in right alongside the spiritual awakening. So I have this experience of reading the book with men, because that's what I knew. I'd always get a little bit afraid. You know, there's that thing, I'm going to save them, or I'm going to give them my wisdom. It's not about me at all. It's not about me at all. My job is to sit and listen and read the book and tell them my experience with the steps and pass them along to someone who might have some experience that I don't have. And I'll talk about that. But some of the places this has taken me is I sponsored this guy named Sean. And I didn't originally sponsor him. He was in and out of the program. He'd been in and out of prison. He was a colorful guy. Like, he liked to rob banks. And he'd spent some time in prison. But he was being sponsored by someone. But I liked this guy. He's a very charismatic person. And he's a very good musician. And I'm a musician. So there was a lot of attraction. And he was sitting in his car outside of a meeting one day. And he motioned for me to get into his car. And for all I knew, he was working the steps. For all I knew, that's what he was doing with his sponsor. And I got in the car, and it was full of smoke, marijuana smoke. Which is hard to ignore out in front of an AA meeting. And I said to him, I'm sorry, I should stand up out of respect for you. But I said to him, I go, "Sean, when you did your fifth step, did you tell the whole truth? Did you keep anything back? Do you have some secrets?" And he looked at me and goes, how did you know? Like I was psychic. And I said, I just a hunch, you know. But he not that day, but very soon after that, he asked me to sponsor him. And then he disappeared. I didn't see him. And then he called me. I got one of those collect calls from jail. This is a call from the Wyoming jail. And, you know, will you accept the charges? And Sean had this grand idea that he was going to get sober, but he didn't want to go to sober living. So he was going to sell 180 pounds of pot and then get an apartment and then get sober. And the reason I tell you this long story is that when he got out on bail and was able to come back to California before he went to trial, and he was afraid. He'd been to prison. He didn't want to go back. He was scared to death. And we did the steps together. We read the book, a simple thing. We went from the doctor's opinion through the steps. We knelt on the ground, and we did the third step together. And then when it got to the fifth step, he came to my office. And I used to have an office near the airport, and he walked in, and he was smoking a cigarette. And a very big sign in my office is no smoking. And I just ignored it because he was so nervous about this fifth step. And while he was smoking that cigarette, he lit a second cigarette. So he had two going in my no-smoking office. But he was in so much pain and so scared that I didn't dare say anything to him. And he did this fifth step, and he told me everything, as far as I can tell. And at the end of it, I had an intuitive thought. And I think sometimes the intuitive thought is God helping us sponsor these men. And he had told me where he'd gone in life, and it was pretty horrible. And I said, and I've never said this to anyone before, and I don't know why I said it, but I said, do you think that you're incapable of being loved by God because of that? And I can tell you that that's not true, that God, I love you, and God can... it loves you wholeheartedly. And I don't know where that came from. And Sean has not had a drink since. And that had nothing to do with me. Nothing to do with me. Absolutely. Anyone, God would have put those words in anyone's mouth. And where that took me was I went to court with Sean. I went to Green River, Wyoming. And it would be a great, you know, Quentin Tarantino movie for me to tell you about that. But we did kneel on the steps. We were walking up the stairs to the courthouse, and I said, here's where we kneel and do the third step prayer. And Sean is a very cool cat, and this wasn't his idea of sponsorship. And we knelt on the ground, and we did the third step prayer. And then we went inside, and the judge talked to Sean for a while. This was a preliminary hearing. And then he said, who are you? And I said, I'm his sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, is Sean going to drink again? And I said, I don't know. And he looked a little puzzled. And I said, is he going to get in trouble with drugs? I said, I don't know. I don't know if I am. I said, but when he's sober, he's a good man. And we spent some time there, and we went back to our hotel room and waited nervously for the call. And the sentence went from 10 to 15 years to 2 to 5 years from us going there and talking to him. And Sean got out in a year because he started Alcoholics Anonymous in that prison. And he did what it took to be a sober man in prison. And the point of this story is, I did not want to go to Green River, Wyoming. It's 16 below zero there. Sean's not that great a company when he's about to go to court. It wasn't a pleasure trip. But the men in Alcoholics Anonymous loved me without boundaries. Now, there's a fine line, and I want to be really, really clear about this. There is one program. Bill said it last night. There's one program. There are 12 steps. They are necessary steps, I believe, for a spiritual awakening. But, and there's a rigidity about that. There's a rightness and there's a right way and a wrong way to do the steps. But that doesn't mean that all I can talk to you about is the big book. That doesn't mean that all we have to do is say, oh, well, if we're not talking about the steps, I'm going to hang up on you. Certainly, you need to bring it back to that. Certainly, I need to say what I have to offer is the program. But what step is it when you go to Green River, Wyoming? It's step 12. What step is it when you duck the big book and then find out you're still sponsoring the guy because he's melting in your arms? It's step 12. If you're going to carry a message about a spiritual awakening, you have to demonstrate that you're awake spiritually. It's mind-boggling. But and the people that have and the other fine line that I will tell you is that I used to think these guys had to like me, you know, and they don't have to like you. We were talking about it this morning. There's another very simple rule: care more about their lives, saving their lives, than about hurting their feelings. because some of the people that have really, really helped me have embarrassed me. They've called me on my BS. They don't co-sign my bullshit. They tell me, you know, you're not doing the right thing. And they're my true friends. They're my true friends. But there is, I will point out to this, we often talk about, and then he thumped me on the chest and said this, I have read the big book. There is no chapter that says, then thump them on the chest vigorously. It says over and over, love, 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 love and tolerance. And you have to, from my personal experience, from my health and Alcoholics Anonymous, and the best I've done with sponsorship is that I have accompanied the program of Alcoholics Anonymous with a love and compassion, the kind of love and compassion that was shown to me when a man turned to me and said, that's real stuff you're going through. Don't worry, we're going to hang in there with you. And he was about to have his leg amputated. That's love, that's compassion. Just real quickly about the results. If you were here on Friday night, you know that I happen to be one of the lucky men in the world who met the woman of their dreams in sobriety. She's not an alcoholic. She's not sober. She puts up with us, but she's not one of us. And she had a stroke. And when that happened, I was really quite surprised and taken aback and terrified, and really got me down into whether I had anything at all to go by, to live by. And it was about, I don't know, like 5 or 6 in the morning. It was very early in the morning. I'd been in the hospital all night with her the night it happened. And I called my sponsor. And the first thing he said, which was a very good thing, was people say there are no big deals in Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, that's not true. This is a big deal. And I was good. I needed someone to tell me because I knew it was a big deal. But I didn't want to feel like an idiot for thinking, oh, I'm not spiritual enough because I'm not calm in the situation, you know, and he helped me with that. And then he said, I want you to call Jay, him. And I go, I don't want to call Jay. I want to talk to you. And he said, no, I want you to hang up and call Jay. And I'm like, what kind of BS is this, man? I call my sponsor. I need my sponsor. He goes, just hang up and call Jay. So I hang up and I call Jay. And Jay and Adele are both awake, or I woke them. And he said, he listened to me, and he said, you know, Adele has had several strokes. And suddenly I had experience on the other end of the phone. It was what I needed, exactly what I needed. And he talked to me about it, and then Adele talked to me about it, about what my wife was going through, which was an important experience. And then Jay got on the phone, and he said something that really was the guiding light for me in this experience. As he said, well, Matthew, you've always wanted to be the world's greatest lover. Now God has given you your chance. And I went back into that room, and I knew what to do. And I knew it wasn't about me. It was about her. It was about how I could serve her. And I want to just give you the epilogue to that. So we bravely decided this stroke wasn't going to change our lives. And in fact, I have to give kudos to my wife. When they wheeled her out of the hospital after 5 weeks in the hospital in a wheelchair, and it looked really bad for her prognosis, she said, okay, this is the moment this stroke stops becoming the center of our lives. Our lives is the center of our lives, our children. So we got home, and I was pretending that I was super sober man, and I actually fell asleep. I had a one-year-old baby and a three-year-old baby and a seven-year-old baby, and my wife was paralyzed, and I had a new job, and I sponsored a bunch of guys. No problem. And I remember once falling asleep, standing up, vacuuming. I woke up, and I was standing, leaning against the wall. And my solution was, I no longer need to vacuum. And because obviously it puts me to sleep. So several months into this, I was driving on the 710 freeway, which means nothing to you, but I was driving on this freeway, and I was like, they're going to fire me from my job. I know it. I know they're going to figure out that I'm spread too thin. And my wife really is going to wake up screaming and go, why did I marry this guy? And she's going to get in her wheelchair and get the hell out. And my kids are going to jump up and go, you're a shitty father. Don't you know that? And they're going to leave, and I'm going to be broke and have no house. And this is within, you know, a minute and a half on the 710 freeway. And I called Jay. I didn't make the mistake of calling him. And I called Jay. And I said, my wife is going to leave me, and I'm a terrible employee, and my kids know I'm a shitty father, and pretty soon I'm going to be homeless. And he listened very carefully, and he said, really beautiful. It was calm and quiet on the other end of the phone. He said, let's pretend for just a minute that you're not in charge. And I started laughing like you're laughing. And I said, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And what Jay did, and the line I want to talk about is, he loved me and brought me back to the principle of the program. Thanks for letting me share.
I think Matthew is still the best sponsor in AA, don't you?
I don't think we'll demote him.
No. We were talking about this earlier, and we couldn't find anybody to replace you as best sponsor in AA. he really cares about it, man. He put his house up for Sean. And he did. And I would have never done that. This guy, Sean, robbed 35 banks in the San Fernando Valley. And he told me one time, he says, you know what my mistake was? I said, no, what? He goes, 35. I should have stuck with 34. He's wacko.
He's
whacked. Just whacked. I used to stand up at podiums in AA speaking and say that if you were on medication, you weren't sober. And the reason I said that is because I heard some of you say that. I heard people in AA say that. And I wanted to be a right-wing badass death squad AA dude, you know, and it seemed like a real badass, hard-ass opinion to have, and a certain amount of truth to it, and I had absolutely no experience with it, but I really liked the opinion, and so I would go around and say that, and then one day a guy came up to me, and he asked me to sponsor him, and he says, I think I should tell you that I'm bipolar, and I'm on medication, and I went, oh, shit. One of these losers, you know. And but I've been raised where you never say no. You don't get to say no. You just say yes. Now, if you want to hang on to prejudice, you have to keep it across the room. You can't let it get too close. If you let it get too close, you realize that there's part of you that's like that. And then it's really difficult to hang on to the prejudice or the opinion or whatever it might be. You got to keep it over there where you can continue to judge it from afar. So I told this guy, I said, okay, I'll work with you. And I figured maybe I could talk him out of taking the medication or something. You know, I was brilliant. And so time went on, and I began to read the book with this guy. And I had the experience, I watched his highs and lows. One time, he called, Karen and I were at home, we had another AA couple over at the house, we were having dinner, and this guy called up, and he was just panicked. He was enraged, he was flipping out, and he was crying, and I said, can you get over here? Can you come over here? And he goes, okay, I'll try. And I hung up the phone and I thought, you know, I mean, he sounded so bad, I second-guessed myself. And I said, man, I should have maybe driven over there to get him. I didn't know that he was even safe on the street. I've actually had conversations with this guy where I've told him, I said, on the phone, and I've said to him, pull the car over. Stop, literally, stop the car. Stop driving. You know, and he would go, okay. And he'd pull over and stop, and then we would continue the conversation as he's on the side of the freeway. And this guy is just wacko. And so he makes it over to the house that night. He comes walking in the front door. He sees me across the room, and he comes walking across the living room, and he's a 40-year-old man, curled up in my lap and stuck his head in my neck and just cried like a little baby. And I just stood there and held him. The couple that was at the house said, well, we think we'll leave now. And Karen walked across the living room, looked at us, and went, whoa. You know, it's like, and I just sat there and, you know, and just held him and talked him down. You know, I mean, it's like, what do you say? A lot of times, nothing. A lot of times, there's nothing to say. He just needed to be in a place where he felt safe. Okay? So I've had the experience with this man of peeling him off the ceiling and lifting him up off the floor. Now when I see him coming, I look at him and I go, have you taken your medication? Because you're sick, man. You know. And what I learned is I had an opinion, then I had an experience, and it changed my opinion. People have demons I don't have. It's as simple as that. How do you learn that? How do you learn that people are different? It's all well and good to take a rigid line about certain things. When you're dealing with people, it's really hard to maintain that rigidity. They're just different. They have different issues and different problems. Myself, personally, I find these differences absolutely fascinating. I mean, at my age, I'm almost 60 years old. I'm 22 years sober. I find myself pretty boring. I mean, I'm done with the search for self. I've been relieved of that, thank God, because it just doesn't go anywhere. It's a never-ending, dull and boring process, you know? You, on the other hand, are a never-ending font of weirdness. You know, I mean, it just goes on and on, you know. You bring things to my attention that I would have never considered, you know. I mean, I had no idea, you know. It's like you hear people say, you know, I've heard a lot of fifth steps, you know, and they're all the same. And then I share some of my stuff. I've heard some shit that shocked the hell out of me. I look at people and I go, well, how many of them were there? You know, like, really? You know, I mean, I'm impressed, you know. I told one guy, I said, you never have to go out there again. You've done it all. I don't think there's anything left, you know. Jeez, you know, I mean, and I love it, you know. I'm not as shocked by it as I am just fascinated, you know. It's like... You know, it's stunning. So my experience of working with people is, if you and I want to keep this thing fresh, that's what we'll do. That's what keeps it fresh. What expands my heart is working with you. Now, I've had some experiences with people. I've had a couple of guys that I've sponsored over the years that I really did not like. I had one guy that I just didn't like him. Every time he came around, I just felt slimy. You know, guy was a creep. You know, some people are just creepy. You know, and those creepy people, I think that there's a rule. You know, that you don't have to deal with creepy people. You know, And what I come to find out with this guy is that he touched the creepy part in me, you know, because I'm a creep, you know, and he had that aspect of his nature. Well, he'd come around, and we're reading the book together, and he's not really doing much, but he's doing enough to keep the ball rolling, you know. And finally one night, and he used to tell me that he was considering suicide, you know, that he would call me up on a fairly regular basis and talk about that he was suicidal, and this girl had left him, and he was really suicidal. So I described to him how to do it correctly, that if he was going to do it, you know, because we really didn't want to have to visit him in the hospital, you know. And I said, now, what you do is you walk out into the ocean about waist deep, and you put a .45 slug through your head. And if you miss a little bit, you'll fall into the water and drown. Because you want to be sure that you do it, you know. Jay just reminded me of something. And the other thing, this guy was staying in the apartment over my office in Bill's halfway house. And we've had some remarkable characters in this place. And when this girl left him, he started doing satanic rituals. He had like a pentacle on the floor, and there were candles burning and stuff. Now, my office is right below it, so, you know, I can hear weird sounds and strange smells. And I walked up there one day, and he's in there, you know, and there's no windows in this place. It's really pretty creepy. And the creep was staying in the creepy place. You know? And here's the pentacle and the candles. And I walked in there, I looked at him, I said, "You got to cut this out. There's no devil worship here." You know, it's like, you know, I wasn't very understanding. And but anyway, one night this guy called me. And he was really down. And he was at a meeting at a place called Clark Stadium. And he said, I really need to talk. So I didn't want to go. I didn't like the guy. I didn't really want to, you know. And sometimes I'm touched with how little compassion I have. You know, a lot of times I think I'm very compassionate and very caring, or I want to be. But there's sometimes I just don't care, and it kind of scares me. You know, when I get that don't care feeling, I don't like that. So I got in my car and I drove down there, and I'll never forget that he was sitting up on the stoop of the front step of this place, and I was standing down on the grass, so I was kind of looking up at him. And he was sitting up there, and he started talking to me about how he felt about himself and just how what a loser he felt that he was and how sad he was. And I connected with him. I'd been working with this guy for a couple of years, and I finally connected with him. I felt him in me. I could feel what he was feeling. At least that's the way I verbalize it. You know, whether it's empathy, I'm not sure what it is, but it seems to me that I can feel your emotional state. And when I make that connection, everything changes. You know, it didn't make him any less of a creep. I just got more in touch with my creepness, you know? And then I was, yeah, my inner creepness. Yeah, that's what it is, you know? And the creep within, you know? It's like, this is a new workshop. The creep workshop, you know? Yeah.
So, we've got a dance.
So the next day he comes over to my house. We had a long talk into the night that night. And the next day he comes over to my house, and I'm working in the garage. And he looks at me and he goes, "What do you want me to do?" And I said, "Well, why don't you go make amends to your sister?" And I kind of turned away, and I turned around, and he was gone. And he got in his car and he left. About an hour and a half later, he came back and he goes, "What do you want me to do now?" And it, like, he just he had nowhere to go, nothing to do, and he made his amends, and we moved on, you know. So the experience, the only way that I gain this experience is what he has taught me. And I've watched him go through it, and I watched Matthew go through it. And anybody that really gets involved in this is you get into situations that you don't understand, you don't know what to do, you don't know what to say. That's when we're growing. That's when it happens. If I don't put any parameters on this, you will take me into places that I really don't want to go. Places I don't want to go. Places I'm not comfortable with and I'm not in charge of. I'm not in control of. And you will take me there. And when I go there, when I come out of that experience, I'm a bit of a deeper person. I have a more of a depth of understanding. I'm closer to you than I was before. And the next person that comes around, that comes within my sphere of influence, will reap the benefit of that experience that I've gained from you. And that's how we pass it on. So if there's anything I can say about this that hopefully you can take away with you, there is no other work in AA. There is nothing else to do. There's only one reason why you and I were saved. Every one of us at some point has to stand and ask themselves, why was I saved? Why? I think we all come to that at some point. Why am I here? Why am I sober and I watch these other people that are equally as deserving and for some reason they don't get the sobriety? What's going on here? I think the answer to that is, the reason I was saved is to try to save you. That I'm the vehicle that God uses. And if there's any job I have at all, it's to try to hone this instrument, to allow myself to be used, to let it happen to me, to don't put any limitations on it or parameters or anything, to just be swept into it. And what I see in the people I work with and what all of us have experienced is I watch people not be able to do that. They can't, for whatever reason, they can't let themselves go into it. And then they wonder why they're not reaping the benefit. Where's mine? You know? If I let you sweep me into this stream, whatever's supposed to happen to me will.
Jay the alcoholic. And God's doing for me today what I couldn't do for myself. Any Sunday morning drinkers here? Isn't it nice to be drinking without the amateurs? You know? I mean, Sunday morning drinking is serious drinking. You don't have to apologize to anybody. You don't have to, you know, it's just a wonderful thing. So Tim called me, you know, we talked about, sometimes it sounds like all we're doing is throwing the death card around here when we talk about, you know, the benefits of sponsorship and being there for our parents and all that kind of stuff. But you also get, one of the things I like to say is that today you'll see me someplace. And I'll be walking down the street and I'll be looking for a cigarette that I can smoke. But today it's not going to be very good because it's damp out. And I don't have enough to drink. I haven't washed in a couple of days. Oven by myself. Oven by my own power. That's where I end up. On the street, alone, looking for something to drink. I don't care about eating. You know, I don't care about any of that stuff. And then what happened is I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had the grace to see that this was the way out for me. And so I bought the package. I bought the whole package. And out of that has come a wealth of experiences that are beyond my wildest dreams. Who could dream of Reykjavik? I mean, really. God must have been on some really good acid when he created Reykjavik. And Chuck. Well, I think that was when God was shooting methamphetamine. But that's another thing entirely. I know more about Chuck than is safe to know. But you get the calls. See, I was like a cat when I drank. You know when a pet gets sick, how they hide? Especially a cat, they go away and hide. And that's what my alcoholism did to me. And what sponsorship has done is it has called me forth from the cave. It, you know, it's brought me out into life. And so I'm sitting at home one day, and I get a phone call from South Bay Hospital. It goes, it's happened. Get down here. So I get in the car and I drive down to South Bay Hospital. Now, at the time, I was 28 years old, and I was 32, and I'd never been in a hospital when a baby had been born. And I wasn't there for the birth, but I was invited in just afterwards. And you know the energy in that is it's the holiest place in the world. There is no place that's holier. And so I walk in and I'm just stunned by the energy, you know, and I see his wife and the baby and all that good stuff, and there, it's all wonderful, and it was so wonderful that I had to remove myself quickly, and my wife Jacqueline and I had been trying to get pregnant at that time. And I walked out into the parking lot of the hospital, and I went, you know, God, I'd really, really like to have that experience. If it be your will, let me have that experience. Let Jackie and I have that experience. And that was the evening that my daughter was conceived.
So you got to be careful.
Yeah, exactly. Like the first wife. And Jacqueline just turned 22 years sober this week. So the other thing that Alcoholics Anonymous does is it makes us pay attention to our lives. In other words, I remembered saying the prayer when we found out, when the pregnancy test worked. It was like, oh my goodness. So that's one of the wonderful, wonderful benefits. I believe more that alcoholism is a disease today than I did when I came in, when I worked the steps, because of the fifth steps I've heard. Now, I don't get maybe the same colorful ones, but I'm well familiar with this case. And I truly believe that that alcoholism is a disease more now than I ever did before because of all the fifth steps I've heard. And you see, because they're all the same. I believe they are all the same. Sam Shoemaker, Bill Wilson's, who was the Oxford Group Episcopal rector that Bill Wilson went to his church when he got out of Towns Hospital. It's where he went to three meetings a week for 2.5 years. Sam Shoemaker always said that there is only one sin. Only one. There is only one mistake. And that is believing that I'm different. And I think that every alcoholic in the world believes that to the core of their being. You don't understand. I'm different. Now, the thing about that is that with, you know, at least with me, and I'm a big fan of the Oxford Group line, that it's men's work with men and women's work with women. You know, Bill's come with some pretty lofty arguments and really, you know, good ideas about why he should get to sponsor women, and I still am not convinced.
You know,
maybe after 70. We'll see.
Maybe.
And I still don't have. Yes. Anyway, yeah. Science will one day. Anyway. But see, we all get sick in exactly the same way. And alcoholic males, we all get sick in the same way. We're not that complex. There's really not that much we can do. I mean, we just can't. Now, some of us are more flamboyant than others. You know, with some, it's our daughter's piggy bank. With others, it's banks. But it's, you know, I still think that the people that rob their daughter's piggy banks suffer more than the gangsters that are sticking up the banks, myself. So there's just, in this sponsorship thing, is that I see that I am not different. And what happens is that each time that a man shares his innermost self with me, what happens is that I get to take more and more responsibility for my life and who I am and what the world is around me that I see. And this is the thing that sponsorship does for the sponsor, is that what we do is we get to see and we get to remake the world within which we live. Literally. We are transformed. Because when you see men go out and do these simple spiritual exercises, you know, this is not brain surgery. This is like, come over here and do this. Come over here and do this. Come over here and do that. It's really not that difficult. And you have to trust me when I tell you that what it says in the book is true, when it says that you have to realize that you have now tapped a resource far beyond your own self. And that this resource is the thing that will guide you. And the only difficulty you will have is when you take the reins. And of course, we all do. But what the process of learning to grow in effectiveness is learning more and more to let go of ourselves when being of service to others. To become this channel, to let whatever this power is that saved our lives, work through us instead of trying to manipulate it in order to make it work the way that we think it ought to work. And the greatest thing, you know, one of the wonderful things to see about your community here is all the men and women that are in their 20s and 30s. And one of the things that's happening is, I believe, is that the Spirit is calling so loudly that the children on this planet can no longer tolerate, I think this is the opinion section, can no longer tolerate the absurdity of the materialism that is demonstrated and broadcast at them every moment. And they are getting to harder and faster ways of getting out than ever before. And this deep inner thirst that I will talk about that I had, my alcoholism, that brought me to my knees by the time I was 24 years old, these people are getting here at 15 and 16, which I should have, I very easily could have qualified at that time. And they're getting on the path. They're getting on the path. And what will they do? How much greater will their lives be than what it is that we have had the grace to receive, because they'll have these tools so much younger. And where it is that the steps and sponsorship really, really work is within our homes and how we treat our children and how we treat our wives. And what happened for me is that sponsorship allowed me to be the kind of father that I never, ever could have been. I come from generations of insanity and violence. You know, just and it was the non-alcoholic that was the violent one in my home. Sponsorship has taught me to love people fearlessly. Because, see, I know with a sponsee exactly what they ought to do, exactly how their life ought to be. And if they just follow me, it'd be great. And time after time after time, what happens? They go out and do exactly what it is that they want to do. They end up with her. They go off. You know, I mean, the great thing, my friend Bill calls me up and he goes, "She's left me. I think there's a meeting down at the Alano Club." And I'm laying there with my fabulous wife and I go, "Bill, don't go down to the Alano Club looking for her." And what happens is he comes back with her. Karen, the greatest gift in my life. Because without her, I'd have him running amok in Alcoholics Anonymous internationally for decades. So I don't know what's best for them. And I have this experience of having all knowledge, and yet they go out and do what it is that they want to do, and their lives become wonderful. I'm not as smart as I think I am. I'm definitely not as smart as I want my wife to believe that I am. But what happens is that I have watched this power work in men and women's lives in desperate situations. And I know that it's there. So that when my daughter is in a situation that I really don't like, what I can do is I can trust her. The other thing is that I have always been aware who her father was. And I'm prouder that my daughter made it through high school without getting arrested than I am about anything else. I think that's really cool. And I don't think, and I think she made it through without sticking needles in her arm either, which, I think is just great. You know, so, but this is what sponsorship does. Sponsorship allows me to become right-sized. Sponsorship is not about control. Sponsorship is about love. And if you want to grow in likeness of God as I understand God, It's love. It's love. Now, I've had the wonderful opportunity to pray and meditate with lots of people, go lots of spots, do lots of things. For those of you who are allergic to Christianity, this is not a pitch for it, okay? Don't confuse. Remember, especially when I talk later, when I say God, I'm not saying what you think I'm saying, okay? I'm talking about this experience that I've had within the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Dr. Bob, who is our co-founder, had a book that he loved, and it was by a gentleman by the name of Henry Drummond. And the book is called The Greatest Thing in the World. And what Drummond did was that he went all over the world preaching. He was Dwight Moody's right-hand man. He was to me what Cleveland is. He had this incredible gift of working with people, and he went around the world preaching. And it used to be that the translations of Paul's letter to the Corinthians, which when you go to religious weddings, they talk about love. Love is patient. Love is kind. It used to be translated as charity. And Drummond was the one who popularized it being the word love, not charity. And in it, it talks about, and what Dr. Bob would do before the big book was written and after is every man that he worked with, he had them read this book. It's only about 40 pages long. And then he would have them come and talk to him about it because he wanted to make sure that they understood it. But one of the things that that Paul talks about in that letter is that I can have all knowledge. I can have all power. But if I have love, if I don't have love, it is not worth anything. Part of the process of sponsorship is that you're going to do it with power. You're going to do it with knowledge. You're going to do it correctly. And you need to do that. You need to get on fire. You need to transmit the message just right. But sooner or later, what's going to have to happen is either you're going to learn to love or you will just sound like a clanging gong. There won't be anything there. And we all know people that I call personalities in Alcoholics Anonymous, in politics and religion and all kinds of walks of public life that are nothing but a rigid, fixed, ungiving thing. And what sponsorship is it's giving, and it's giving love. It is a wild adventure. Don't miss it. It is the greatest thing in the world.
All right, everybody wave at us.
Wave at us.
Hey. Hello, Reykjavik.
This is an anonymous program. You people just blew it.
Nobody will ever know.
So we're going to do the...
Do you want to ask for questions?
Does anybody have any questions or comments about how you work with people? You gotta have a question.
We're all afraid of somebody else's opinion.
Well, we heard this in the '60s, well, '70s, so all you need is love.
It was really good then too.
Yeah.
Long with the LSD.
Yes, sir.
Whatever you do, don't become a hippie.
Exhibit A.
He does stuff I don't understand him.
We have to
I think the point that we're trying to make, if you listen to the whole weekend, some of the major misconceptions about sponsorship is the whole idea of control and about telling people how to live their lives. And essentially what we do, when Jay says it's not rocket science, is we sit and we read the book with them. And if you have an understanding of the 12 steps, if you believe that you have an understanding of how the process should be done, that's what you deliver. That's what you do. Now, if you're sitting there with somebody and you're reading chapter after chapter and they're not doing their inventory and they're arguing with you and it's not going the way you think it should go, he's not following the rules, you know? What we're telling you is don't fire them. Be compassionate. Be understanding. Don't shut the door on them. Don't send them away. Adjust your approach. Pay attention. Listen up. Okay? Rigidity precludes that. There is no humanity in rigidity. And I'm as rigid as anybody. I mean, I know how it should be done. I have a depth of knowledge of the 12 steps that would scare the shit out of you. You know, and I've been doing it for years. You know, and people come and ask me questions all the time. Well, what about this and what about that? And, you know, I may not be a Talmudic scholar about it, but I have an understanding of how it should be done. And if you don't do it that way... Ego deflation at depth. If you don't do it that way, I will argue with you. You know, I mean, I'm not shy, okay? But in that quiet room, in that room where you and I are just sitting together, none of that means anything. I mean, literally, it doesn't mean anything. Because what we're doing is we're sharing our lives. That's what's really going on. And the other aspect of it is, what do you do with somebody when they've worked the steps? What the guys didn't know in the early days of AA, they didn't have any concept of long-term sponsorship, of emotional sobriety. Wilson said very clearly that emotional sobriety is significantly more important than physical sobriety. Physical sobriety has been done. What do we do now with all this crap that's coming up? What happens? You know, I mean, there's actually people in AA that will not read the 12 and 12, which is beyond my comprehension. I don't understand what that's all about, you know. I mean, why wouldn't I read what that man wrote after he was 3 years sober and learn some stuff of years of dealing with depression and sponsoring thousands of people? Why would I discount that? Am I stupid? You know? Isn't there more to it? Aren't there other people that have an understanding of this? I need that information. So when I'm sitting there in the room with you alone and you're bearing your soul to me, am I going to cut you off because you're not reading page 32? You know? No, I think there needs to be some humanity in it. And if you do this work long enough, that is what happens. You'll either burn out and blow up, or you will adjust and adapt. Does that mean that you'll change your approach to working the 12 steps? No, probably not. I mean, when people come to me, what is it they want from me? They want that recovery. The primary thing I have to offer them is the process of working the steps. Never lose sight of that. You always gently, it's like meditation, you know, you sit in meditation and your mind wanders. You gently bring it back to focus. Gently. Gently. And with people, that's the same way. Gently. With love. With compassion. These people are damaged. They're hurt. Just like you. They're untrusting. They're frightened. And they can't say so. But you know they're frightened. You know? I mean, I get gangsters all the time and I look at them and it's hard for me to keep a straight face because I go, when is this guy going to become a blubbering mess, you know? Because if he sticks around, he's going to drop all the hard-ass bullshit, you know? He's a frightened little boy just like me.
It's been really an honor, an interesting thing to listen to the different people we've come into contact with here. And I want to address your question. First of all, my experience is I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and like a lot of you, I saw people that were, I got in with some people and I did the steps and my life changed. So I had this experience. It was a limited experience. It felt like an expansive experience because my life changed. But it was my one-pointed, my brain going through the steps. And I looked around and I saw people whose lives weren't changing, who weren't during the steps. So I got the right and wrong idea. What I think the mistake I made, and it may be, you may have some empathy with this, is that then I went out to carry the message and I had my narrow perspective. And I felt like if they didn't do it exactly like I thought it was supposed to look, then they were doing it incorrectly. That is not how it was given to me. Again, I know we're skating very thin ice with all this Christianity, but you do have to realize that that was a very powerful force in Dr. Bob's life, and they meditated with the Holy Spirit, and they read the Bible. And there's a line in Matthew 13 that says, how can you see the speck of dust in your brother's eye when there's a plank in your own? The next line is, first, learn to remove the plank from your own, and you will know better how to remove the speck of dust. And what I've taken that to, in my experience, is the people who've really woke me up, people who've really changed my life, weren't yelling at me. And the thing about alcoholics that Bill says is that when you come to Alcoholics Anonymous, if you haven't been yelled at by hundreds of people, you haven't drank enough. You know, I mean, there's... So when if a sponsor, I'll just say this. This is the easiest way to put it. If you want to read the most gentle and loving literature in Alcoholics Anonymous, read the chapter called Working with Others. It is all about attraction. It is all about patience and tolerance. It is all about cultivating empathy. That's what that chapter says. And you know where they learned to write that? From their experience. If you read Bill's story, he failed and failed and failed. And then somebody said, stop preaching at them, Bill. And he started to... Then Bob came. And he said, you know, I think we have a disease, Bob. Bob's a doctor. He's interested. Then he said, I had these problems. How about you? Bob said, I've had those problems. He won his trust. He won. And the thing that I think our frustration, if I can share the international frustration of sponsorship, is we can't give them motivation. We can't give them desperation. If I could bottle desperation, I'd be a rich man. Because we could change lives. Oh, you don't have enough. Drink this. Desperation is sold at the bar. But when they come to us, what we have to offer is example. We have to offer not only that we're living correctly, and we did it right, because look at me, look at my wife, look at my house, look at my kids. What we have to offer is, I'm sick like you, and I found a way to have a wife and a house and a kids and not blow my brains out. That, so if you're worried that you're going to lose the rigidity, you probably need a little bit of love. If you're worried that you're going to lose the love, you should add some rigidity.
I had a guy one time, I was sitting and I was preaching to him. Jay always told me, he says, when their eyes roll back in their head, you've gone on too long. And I was preaching to a guy one time in my office, and I could see his head was kind of getting lower on the table as he was like just crushed under the weight of information. And he actually raised his hand to stop me. Like this, you know. And so I stopped. And he says, you know, I didn't ask you to sponsor me because I think you're so smart. And I thought to myself, I think I even said to the guy, well, why did you ask me? I was clueless, you know. You know. I don't remember what his answer was, but it was certainly an awakening. You know, it was something about I need help not drinking. You know, it's like, you know. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
Yes, when in your sobriety, were you able to apply the principle of tough love in your sponsoring?
Oh, yeah, tough love. When were we able to apply the principle of tough love? I will eventually get in your face. Eventually, I will confront you. And I think over the years, I've gotten significantly better at that, at the timing of it. I mean, what we're talking about, when you're rigid, it's happening all the time. And it's not working. It doesn't work. My experience with that is it just doesn't work. Some people, it's like being, I'm an employer. I've been an employer forever, you know, and I've had a lot of people working for me. And I've been an oppressive boss. And what I surround myself with is people that will take that oppression. I get a lot of yes people. You don't get a lot of free thinkers when you're an asshole. You know, the free thinkers have a tendency to go to people that don't have ego problems and aren't afraid of their free thinking. Sponsorship is very much the same way. You know, if you get a following and you're an oppressive asshole, you get a bunch of like automatons, little plastic people walking around going, "Work the steps, work the steps, work the steps." You know, it's like.
Yeah. And that's a really fun place to be on the path.
Yes.
It is.
Yeah. I mean, these are all phases that you go through. I think over the years where the tough love comes in is when I can reel somebody back in. If I've gained their confidence, you know, if they know in their hearts that I'm not trying to hurt them, they will listen to me when I reel them back in. Recently, there was a guy that was in this very sick relationship with a woman. And this guy's been sober for a while, and he's done the work, and he sponsors people, and he just found himself in this very sick relationship, you know, where they would, you know, manically have sex for a few days, and then she would just whack him in the head with a 2x4, you know. It was like, it was really painful, you know, and she'd just start picking him apart and yell at him and stuff, you know, and I suspect that he may have had something to do with that, you know. I doubt that it was one-sided. And he would continue to call and talk to me about this. And finally, I told him, I said, if you walk back in there, if you walk back through that door and you know she's on the other side of the door and she's waiting there with the 2x4, you know it because she's always waiting there for you. If you walk back in that door, you have lost the right to snivel to me about this ever again. I don't ever want to hear about it anymore. So I didn't hear from him for a couple of days. And then finally he called and I said, did you walk back in there? He goes, yes. He says, but I'm not sniffling. I'm not going to sniffle about it, you know. And, you know, I've had guys where I've watched them drifting away from AA. And I related one story, I think, yesterday it was, about the guy that I told him. I said, you know, I'm watching you leave. You're leaving. It's like saying, I mean, this guy would be, his friends are around him, right? And friends are supportive. That's what friends are about, being supportive. I'm not this guy's friend. I'm his sponsor. So a lot of times what the sponsor does is he yells out, the emperor has no clothes. You're getting ready to drink. I'm watching you get ready. And they look at you like, how can you say that to me? I mean, their response in many ways is, you know, they'll be violently, they'll respond. Who are you to tell me that? You know, I can take care of myself. And this guy looked at me and he says, so you're telling me your way's the only way? And I look at him, the old rigidity comes back and I go, pretty much. You know, we're talking AA, right? Isn't that what we're talking about? We're not talking about you and your program down at Long Beach City College to be an accountant. And whether you signed up for the correct classes, and I don't know anything about that. We're talking about Alcoholics Anonymous, and you're not going to meetings. You're not calling me. And you're running around. You're working at a recovery place, and you're having sex with one of the women that's in the place, and they don't know about it. You're fucked up.
Any other questions? Yes, sir.
I have one question.
correct. The question is, can you work the steps too quickly? And what's the format, the proper format, I guess? Really, can you do it too quick? I did it very quickly myself. I have one of the things that I've seen is that I've seen people that have been around the program for years. I mean, a long time. In our home group, which, by the way, if you want to know about rigidity, we're going to talk about it in a minute. But the code name, we each have flags for our meetings back in Los Angeles. It's a very strange thing. And our thing is work the steps or die, and then a description of an act that happens between a boy and his mother. And it's a thing of, you know, we got to work the steps, we got to work the steps, we got to work the steps. There were two men that were members of this meeting that had gone in and out for ages. And both of them had guys that when they came back this one time, they got them in the parking lot and they prayed with them and they sent them home to do their four step and they wrote their four steps, did their fifth step, and they're both still sober. One of them's still in AA and one's not. But those guys were really bad cases and they're sober. Okay? So one of the things that happens along the continuum is that you learn, what is it that I'm doing here? Is this battlefield surgery, or am I here at the hospital doing something that I've got the time and I've got the sutures and this higher power will tell you. And if somebody's telling you, no, you got to take them out in the parking lot from the meeting, get them down to pray and start their fourth step immediately, if that's their experience, it's wonderful. Don't ever tell somebody, you know, don't. Back to the old inner hippie. I've been called out. I might as well defend myself. I got Stan and Kyle, and what calling somebody out and telling them that their way of working the steps is wrong and their way of sponsoring somebody is wrong, you cannot win in that. You can't win. By their works they will be known. You don't have to say anything. I believe. Because this world is absolutely full of people that are screaming about doing it right and wrong. And they're not helping anybody. My job is to just be there and help them. And you'll find out. Remember, you can't hurt them. You're an intelligent agent of God's creation. And you're trying to help. You can't screw it up. You can't. If God sends them to you, you can't hurt them. And you may see other people being hurt, you know, but don't worry about it. Don't worry about controlling somebody else. It's not helpful, in my experience.
One of the things about how quickly you do it, one of the things that comes up often is you get people that come in and out all the time. And there's the question, every time this guy or woman comes back, should we start at the beginning? And I was, for a long time, was a beginning starter. Well, you clearly didn't get the first step. We need to go back to the first step and find out where it is that we went haywire. Well, I feel a bit differently about that now. I think one of the approaches that you can take with that kind of individual is, what haven't you done? I'll ask them, have you done your inventory? And if they say no, and I go, let's do the four step now. You know, well, shouldn't we start? No, that's just giving you more space to hang out and do nothing for a while. we're going to jump right into that four step. Come on over to my house. I will help you write it. And I'll sit with them if they'll let me, which is rare. And actually help, you know, do the columns and explain it to them and say, start here. Well, I don't have any resentments. Don't say that to me. I don't want to hear that. We're going to start off, put Dad right there. Well, I don't hate my father. Yes, you do. Put Dad right there, you know. And, I mean, when Jay says you can't hurt them, how can you hurt a guy that's constantly coming in and out and he's got nowhere else to go but AA? So the slippers, I will try anyway to just, like, launch them right into it and get them into that nine step as quickly as possible. Maybe that'll create some change. The two guys that Jay talked about in the home group, you know, one's Kirby, right? You know, Joe Kirby. That's what Kirby was in and out. And I watched this happen, and I watched his sponsor say, do your inventory now. As soon as he did that fourth and fifth step, he never drank again. It's been 20 years.
Yeah, we should take a break.
Break time.